Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's special California election series. Yesterday, California citizens voted on 11 statewide propositions, a slew of local measures, the governor's race, and hotly contested House races. Today, we will look at the results with Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez. Joe covers transportation for the San Francisco Examiner. He also writes the weekly political On Guard column. He was out very late last night, so he is joining us on the phone. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rose.
Great to have you. Thank you for waking up for us. David Dayan is contributor to The Intercept and also writes for The Nation, The New Republic, and other outlets. His book, Chain of Title, is about three ordinary Americans who uncovered Wall Street's foreclosure fraud. Really important book. We had David on to talk about that. Hi, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, I was up late, too.
Okay, well, thank you. You couldn't come in because you were in L.A., but thank you for getting up, David. I appreciate it. You know, I want to talk to both of you about voter turnout because, you know, in the last couple weeks, it was exciting to see so many people voting, long lines. But this morning, I was curious about it, and Mother Jones has a piece. Voter turnout was spectacular this year, but not in California. Have either of you looked up the numbers? David?
It's completely unfair and irresponsible to write about turnout numbers in California the day after the election. As you know, ballots can be postmarked on Election Day and sent in, and as long as they are postmarked Election Day, they can be counted. There are as many as 4 million votes that are probably uncounted.
Oh, wow.
This happens almost every election that California, on the day after the election, says, oh, there's low voter turnout. But it turns out it ends up being very high once you count the 4 million ballots that aren't counted.
Okay, that's true. So that's a good point. But
frankly, in San Francisco, even before these uncounted ballots have been tallied, we actually had a pretty high absentee, pretty high mail-in turnout. It was like 121,000 for San Francisco in this election. Amazing, pretty strong numbers coming into it, even just then, and that's before the last of the votes have been tallied.
Okay, so good, strong numbers, and hopefully the numbers will go up in the coming days. Well, let's dive in and talk about some of these important races in California. Dianne Feinstein was reelected with 54% of the vote, but 2.8 million Californians voted for Kevin De Leon. David, Dianne, what are your thoughts? What do you think's next for Kevin De Leon?
Well, I'm not sure what's next, but it is interesting, particularly if you look at the map, because if you look at where De Leon was successful, it really almost looks like a standard Democratic versus Republican map of California. De Leon did very well in the Central Valley. He did well in the sort of bellwether county of San Benito County that a lot of times in the past people would look at, and whoever wins that county usually wins the election. I think what was going on here is that De Leon didn't have a lot of money.
Right.
He did not have the funds to present himself to voters, and this was a Feinstein versus not Feinstein election. And the polls showed this, that De Leon, even though he was running to Feinstein's left, was picking up more support among Republicans, and particularly when Donald Trump sort of cast Feinstein as the villain of the Kavanaugh hearings, I think that turned off a lot of right-leaning voters to Dianne Feinstein. This is someone who has catered to the Central Valley for like her entire career, and yet she lost those voters. But it wasn't enough, because that was more than offset by her strength and San Francisco and Los Angeles counties, which, you know, is what you expect from a Democratic politician to do. It's just a very jumbled set of what actually happened in this race and what the motivations were.
And for governor, Gavin Newsom got 59.4% of the vote. John Cox got 40.6% of the vote. Joe, Gavin Newsom is walking into a tough job. We have a lot of problems in the state of California. Massive inequality, poverty, homelessness. Since you cover San Francisco, you weren't covering San Francisco when Gavin Newsom was mayor, but you are aware of his record. What does his record as mayor of San Francisco tell us about what he will do as governor?
Well, you know, in terms of San Francisco, kind of the liberal democratic spectrum here in San Francisco, Gavin Newsom was more of a centrist, frankly. I mean, if you remove the one remarkable moment of same-sex marriage, the kind of renegade same-sex marriage movement that he kind of helped spark, if you remove that from his record and you just look at kind of the more civic-minded duties, I mean, he heralded Care Not Cash, which was an effort to take cash payments to the homeless out of the equation that was successful and replace that with some level of care, which many would argue didn't ever really equal or kind of live up to the promise of that cash. So the more you know, those who are on kind of a more progressive left spectrum definitely have reasons to be wary of a Newsom administration. But at the same time, you know, if you're a moderate Democrat, he might go down the line on your beliefs.
What are your thoughts, David? What kind of governor do you think Gavin Newsom will be?
Well, I mean, I think one thing is that you have to look on who sort of drove Gavin Newsom into that seat and who really backed him in the primary. And you're talking about groups like the California Nurses Association and some of the more left-leaning groups in California. That's kind of who he's more beholden to. So I'm not sure what his agenda is really going to be to start. I think he's going to talk a lot about building more housing, and I think that's going to ruffle some potentially some feathers among affordable housing groups who see affordability and cost and things like that as more important than increasing supply. I do think that there is going to be a ballot measure, as we know, regarding Prop 13 and in 2020, and I think that Newsom will be all aboard on that in a way that I don't think Jerry Brown would be. Those are a couple of thoughts.
Well, it'll also be interesting to see how he handles the next iteration of State Senator Scott Wiener's SB 827, which would see developments arise near transit corridors. And, you know, it received a lot of blowback initially, but, you know, there's a good chance it'll reach Gavin Newsom's desk in its next iteration.
And did he ever say where he stands on Prop 10? I've heard him say that it goes too far. But Joe, did he come out against Prop 10?
I'm not aware of his stance on Prop 10.
He did.
Okay.
He did come out against Prop 10. He certainly belongs with the sort of supply side theory of how you fix the housing crisis in California.
Well, let's talk about Prop 10. This one went down pretty big, 61% voting no. We've got 95% of precincts reporting, and so much money was spent on this one, more than 100 million, 75 to 100 million on the no side, California Association of Realtors, Blackstone. On the yes side, 26 million, mostly from the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. And the no side had a lot of money to run so many ads during the primetime cable shows. David, what is the significance of Prop 10 going down? And again, Prop 10 would have repealed Costa-Hawkins and allowed local governments to implement rent control laws.
Right. And, you know, these ballot measures are usually dominated by the side that has a lot of money to spend. And we saw this time and time again in this election, that axiom rang true. This was, you know, Prop 10 was really battered on the air by these corporate-funded ads that, you know, simultaneously said, we don't want to, you know, make a bad situation worse, at the same time having a vested interest in protecting their ability to jack up rents to any level that they want. So, you know, What does it mean for the future? It probably means that efforts in the legislature, as you know, there was an effort to repeal Costa-Hawkins through the legislature last year, which did not make it through. And I think that's probably dead for the short term. It's a difficult situation for cities that, with each passing year, that 1995 ban on construction after that point means that less and less homes and properties are eligible for rent control.
Joe, anything to add on Gavin Newsom and rent control and housing?
Well, you know, it's the thing that struck me about Prop 10 and the kind of the fears that were fanned of like rent control busting future building to me seemed even to be debated within the halls of the Yes in My Backyard people, the YIMBY folks, who are the pro-development build groups here in San Francisco. YIMBYSF, you know, ultimately didn't come out strongly in favor of Prop 10, but they had amazing internal debates that I attended where members of YIMBY were really split over this, recognizing that there needs to be a preservation of some people's ability to live even as more housing is built. So I think that the fears that were fanned were overblown even within the kind of more build communities.
Gavin Newsom also came out against San Francisco's Prop C, which will tax large corporations that gross over $50 million to fund homeless services. San Francisco Mayor London Breed also came out strongly against Prop C, and it won with almost 60% of the vote. We were talking last night about how Salesforce CEO Benioff.
Mark Benioff.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mark Benioff came out in favor of Prop C. And I just want to read a statement from Jenny Friedenbach with the Coalition of Homelessness and Kristen Evans, Prop C, Our City, Our Home proponent and a business owner. They write, "The passage of this measure is a resounding voter mandate for desired change around homelessness, giving the city the resources it finally needs to address the crisis, or it needs to finally address the crisis. For thousands of destitute San Franciscans, this has infused hope that they will soon have the opportunity to thrive that only a home can bring." It'll be given, let's see. So these corporations were given a 40% tax cut by the Trump administration, decreasing corporate taxes from 35% to 21%. Prop C has a detailed plan for both its spending and results and mandates community oversight of the funding. So Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez, talk about the significance of Mayor London Breed coming out against Prop C, Gavin Newsom coming out against Prop C, and it won with almost 60% of the vote.
Well, I wrote this in my column in the Examiner today, but, you know, truly everyone I speak to, from political consultants who actually worked on previous campaigns of Newsom's to, the Homeless Coalition themselves, to politicians who don't have skin in the game, everyone agreed that if Mayor Breed had gone in on the proposition, there's a very strong chance that unification, that citywide unification, could have pushed it above a two-thirds voter threshold. Why that's significant is that the proponents are expecting a legal challenge of Prop C based on, you know, how taxes can be approved by voters. And if it had reached above that two-thirds threshold, it would have been less assailable. It would not have been as assailable in court, whereas just getting a simple majority leaves it somewhat open. Talking to Jenny Friedenbach yesterday, she told me, hey, you know, we think we're going to win this. We think even if someone takes us to court, we're going to win this, but it's going to tie up the Prop C funds for at least a year through the court proceedings. And that, I mean, almost demonstrably can be linked to London Breed not coming out for this. And I, in my column today, I hung that on her. It was truly a unfortunate thing to see her come out against it like that, because the messaging that we heard so much in the city from people who were saying that they would vote no was exactly the messaging that, you know, London Breed herself said, that the spending lacked a plan, which it does not. It certainly does have a plan, that there needs to be an audit of how government spends its money. Well, London Breed was on the board of supervisors for years before she was mayor, in charge of the budget. So if she is in charge of the budget and she's saying that props that the homeless spending needs to be audited. Where was that audit for all 4 years on the Board of Supervisors? Where was that deep dive into homeless spending if she felt it was such an important priority for all those years? Why now? So it's just a frustrating message.
Well, and it is frustrating because, Joe, I mean, you wrote a very personal column about this. You wrote about your friend Roger, who was your former student when you were artist in residence at Ruth Asawa San Francisco School of the Arts, and he's now living on the streets. And so you went to the Coalition on Homelessness and you asked organizer Sam Liu, who was leading the Prop C effort, to talk about how this would actually work. Because you can get these sound bites, oh, there's no plan, there's no transparency. And that's what people hear and that's what they believe. So when you spoke with Sam Liu, what did he tell you about how Prop C would actually work on the ground?
Yeah, so, you know, I was a, you know, artist in residence, essentially a teacher for 7 years, and I knew this kid, Roger, when he was getting his first crushes on girls, when he was making art for the first time, when he was having a tough time contemplating suicide. I knew him through all that. And then, you know, fast forward some years, and I'm working as a reporter, and I'm out on 16th Street covering a protest, and someone taps my shoulder and says, Joey, can you give me $20 for food? I say, how do you know my name? He says, Joe, it's me, it's Roger. I couldn't recognize him. He had sunken eyes and ashen skin and just like he looked emaciated. He'd been living in a park. This is my student. This is my friend. And so Sam walked me through all the different ways that Prop C would have helped him. Because me and some former teacher that I worked with immediately tried to get him help. We took him to a hospital. He had been off his medication. We waited 12 hours in UCSF. Parnassus to get him help. 12 hours where Roger was hearing voices and, you know, having anxiety attacks and wanting to leave. We had to buy him pizza to get him to stay. You know, and the first thing Sam Liu tells me is, hey, that wait would be a thing of the past. We would have more mental health services. We would, Prop C would fund more services, to process folks who are in that situation. He wouldn't have had to wait 12 hours. 99% of people don't get that help because they don't have someone who's like a family friend or whatever who's just going to wait with them all that time. The next barrier we found was that because he was going to turn 25, he's now 26 since I first saw him homeless, since he was going to turn 25, he's going to no longer be a transitional age youth. When you're 24, up to 24, 18 to 24, you are a transitional age youth and are eligible for certain types of funding and help. Roger was routinely denied housing and mental health help because he would have turned 25 midway through the care. They said, no way, you're going to turn too old, no help for you. And we couldn't get that. And so Prop C would fund more programs for transitional age youth, and they even allow, Sam Liu said, a lot of these different programs to cultivate help that extends all the way up until you're 30, kind of like an easing out of the transitional age into adulthood, and how to get housing and mental health help. And even before he became homeless, you know, Sam Liu was saying that the Prop C would fund emergency rental assistance that could help so you don't become homeless in the first place. There were so many points along Roger's journey where he tumbled and fell and became more likely to stay in the system of homelessness, which he still is now homeless. And each step along the way, there was an answer on how Prop C's funding would have helped.
Wow. Well, as you said, Prop C did win, but it'll be in the courts, and the funding probably won't be released. Sorry, excuse me. For at least a year. David Dan, I mean, what's going on in L.A. is really incredible and just so sad. L.A.'s homelessness has surged 75% in the last 6 years. I've been on Skid Row once, and I was rendered speechless. I mean, it was shocking. Was there anything on the ballot in Southern California that affects poverty or homeless issues?
Well, we in Los Angeles did our homelessness measure, HHH, which was at the county level, and also Measure H, which is at the city level, in 2016. And both of those passed, and it was a hard-fought battle because they needed a high threshold, but they both went through. The difficulty now is using those funds the plan for Mayor Garcetti is to create these bridge housing ideas where while we wait for the funds to secure and construct permanent supportive housing, to use these temporary facilities to get people off the streets into a safe and stable environment that has services on site. The problem has been that in trying to put these in every council district, all the 13 council districts in Los Angeles, they have run up against a significant amount of NIMBYism, especially where I live in Venice, where they are trying to use an empty bus yard lot owned by the metro system here, and it has caused mass protests. I was at a town hall with the mayor and the local city councilman that hundreds of people who are seemingly finding meaning in their lives by seeing whatever it is they can do to you know, kick people while they're down and keep them from the services they need, you know, just shouting and yelling for hours at this town hall meeting against the proposed plan. Now, I think eventually the first bridge housing has already gone in downtown L.A. There's another plan for Koreatown, another plan. I do think this Venice one will eventually get done, but it's caused a lot of consternation, talk of recalls of city council members, and so that's really the fight that's being waged right now. I will also add that at the statewide level, Prop 2, which allows millionaire tax funding intended for mental health to go toward permanent supportive housing for mentally ill homeless, passed last night. And so that money can be used towards that purpose, with the idea being that mental health, the way that you can best help combat that is by giving people a stable environment to live in. So I think all of these things are coming together, but there is this tremendous resistance to allow some modicum of dignity for one's fellow man. It's kind of eye-opening to see, especially in a liberal area like Venice and all of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Certainly we see that in San Francisco, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, we in the Marina District, which considers itself quite liberal, but by San Francisco standards is fairly kind of moderate conservative. They long pushed back against homeless, a halfway house for homeless youth. And, you know, here they are, you know, trying to call themselves they're calling themselves the center of the Trump resistance at some points. You know, I was at an election party in the Marina last night for a supervisor there, and, you know, NIMBYism does rear its head.
Well, you mentioned Prop 2, which gives the state $2 billion from a 2004 mental health bond measure to house people with mental illnesses. And then Prop 1, a $4 billion bond measure, including $3 billion for construction and preservation of affordable rental housing and $1 billion for loans for veterans to buy homes. That also passed. David, what's the significance of Prop 1 passing?
Well, Prop 1 is an affordable housing bond, and really it's very difficult to get private investors to fund that themselves, and so they just don't want to take the risk. So you do need to borrow money and use that to subsidize these rentals, particularly when you're talking about affordable housing. It fits with Newsom's seeming strategy to use radical increases in supply as the way to solve the affordable housing crisis. I'm not sure that can be the only component, particularly if the housing that ends up getting built, if displacement continues to happen so that you're on this constant yo-yo of building a few more affordable units but taking them away through under move-in evictions and things like that. And number two, it is, you know, without some form of rent stabilization, vacancy control, I just don't see how those things get totally worked out. You know, it's sort of economic theory that if you increase supply, the price will go down. I'm not totally sold on it, but I think it's worth doing everything that we can do to try to arrest this affordable housing crisis while having respect for neighborhoods and respect for the people who are already there. And it's something that California has not figured out how to balance just yet. I think that's very clear, and it's something that you know, certainly there's going to have to be some common ground found.
David Dayan is contributor to The Intercept and author of Chain of Title, a very important book about three Americans who uncovered Wall Street's foreclosure fraud. Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez covers transportation for the San Francisco Examiner and writes the weekly Political On Guard column. Today we are talking about the midterms in California. It's propositions, governor's race. What were you watching? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Lots of local races. What stood out for you? You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's go to Jeffrey in Albany. Hi, Jeffrey. Thanks for holding.
Hi, sure. Thanks for taking my call. I've been listening forever, but never called, so forgive me if I stammer a little. But
no, we're great. We're glad you called.
Okay. I wanted to maybe segue between the last hour and this hour and have the guests see if they agree with the comparison I've drawn for a long time, which is between the split between the progressive wing and the mainstream wing of the Democratic Party and what we've seen in the Republican Party, which is the rise of the Tea Party. And what I see happening in Washington right now is just the end game, the successful end game of the Tea Party movement. So in Albany, I was involved and voted in the Jovanka Beckles, who's the Bernie-crat versus Buffy Wicks race, who's the Obama-endorsed candidate who won. And it seems to me there's so much psychological, if not strategic, emphasis put on these national races, which are obviously important, but nobody's thinking about it in terms of the Tea Party and just straight taking a page out of their playbook and saying we need to be thinking about assembly members, sheriffs, mayors, all these things, and let that bubble up. If the progressive wing wants to see a successful, be successful at the national level.
Well, it's a great point. We did a show, we had a debate with Jovanka Beckles and Buffy Wicks. Jovanka Beckles received endorsements from a number of progressive groups, the Nurses, 350 Bay Area, Our Revolution. She raised just under $350,000. And then Buffy Wicks, she was an organizer for the Obama campaign. She got endorsements from Obama, from Hillary Clinton's campaign, and she raised $1.1 million. And she got a lot of money from tech. She got some money from Ron Conway. So the latest numbers, Buffy Wicks, 50,986 votes. Jovanka Beckles, 40,053 votes. And this was the Assembly District 15 race. Joe, were you following that one? And what are your thoughts about
how to... Can I just throw in real quick before I get cut off, which is my sense on the ground is that Wicks didn't just win on account of money. It's that that was the preference for the more mainstream candidate. And if this is one of the most liberal areas, if Berkeley, Oakland, Richmond isn't sending the more progressive candidate to Sacramento, then where is this going to happen?
Well, tell us more, Jeffrey, because on the show, I mean, there were clear differences when it comes to health care, when it comes to education, housing. What were you hearing from people on the ground about why they chose Buffy Wicks over Jovanka Beckles, especially people who might consider themselves to be progressives?
Sure, yeah. I just caught a piece of that debate, so I'm not totally up to date on all their policy positions, but I was campaigning in front of one of the polling sites and having a nice lively conversation with a Buffy supporter who said, you know, I'm a little older, I'm a little more conservative, and you know, conservative is pretty relative out here, but that was the sense that Buffy, she, you know, she kept saying, well, Buffy helped author the health care bill, and just that she was, and a lot of it was personality-wise. Mm-hmm. I thought there was a sense that she had the personality to do business in Sacramento, and Jovanka didn't, which I think is nonsense. I think we need, the progressive wing needs people who are going to fight for these positions and not just work hard for it. But I think people aren't ready to make that move. It feels radical. It feels crazy. It feels, I think people have the sense that it's just a losing strategy, and I get that, but look at the other side and how they got to where they are. Is they got their radical wing out there.
Well, thank you for calling, Jeffrey. Joe, why don't you take that first and talk about the Bay Area when you see progressives losing against more moderate Democrats?
Yeah, you know, I mean, always a tale of more moderate Democrats kind of being able to marshal forces in small local races against more progressive candidates is often told with money. It's also often told with established ties and at least and able to work up the system and get that Obama endorsement or whatever endorsement that seems wildly out of proportion to the size of the small little race that it's going into. But that type of establishment, that type of system and network that flows from the top of the Democratic organization down to the smallest races, is something that progressives or the left has for a long time mostly lacked. It's like herding cats, right? But you know what I've seen a lot locally here in San Francisco, at least, is an effort to kind of tap into the Democratic Socialist Movement. And Ms. Ocasio-Cortez, for instance, in New York, bringing her into San Francisco and trying to tie her and her policies and her and that kind of fervor into her and energy into her race into some local races here. That didn't pan out with the most recent DSA endorsee, which is Tony Kelly, who ran for supervisor, essentially our city council in San Francisco. Of District 10, which is our southeast neighborhoods, which is mostly Black and Chinese, and it didn't quite work out there. But you're starting to see the kind of beginnings of that try to kind of cohese,
Right. So let me just add that this is a function of the way in which we do elections in California, which is unlike almost every other state in the union. We have this silly top two primary that sends the top two vote getters, regardless of party, to the general election, and you inevitably get these Democrat on Democrat battles in Democratic areas where everyone, including Republicans, including independents, can vote between a progressive and a moderate Democrat. We saw it down here in Southern California in the state Senate race between Susan Rubio and Mike Eng. Mike Eng being the progressive, Susan Rubio being backed by $3 million, I believe, in oil money in the most expensive state legislative race, and Rubio won. It becomes very hard for more progressive individuals to get through that gauntlet in the current way that the system is set up. And unless we change that system, it's always going to be a roadblock. Now, I will add, just because sheriffs were mentioned, very important thing down here in L.A. County. Right now it's razor thin, the difference, but there is a chance that Alex Villanueva, who's the Democratic nominee for L.A. County Sheriff, will win against Alex, Jim McDonnell, who has been collaborating with ICE, who's a Trump supporter, a Republican, Villanueva would be the first Democratic L.A. County sheriff in 130 years, which is staggering to think about, but is true. So I do think that there has been some increased consciousness around criminal justice issues, and particularly those races like district attorney, like sheriff, that are critical to having a greater appreciation for needs in criminal justice and to end things like rampant discrimination and brutality and collaboration with an anti-immigrant administration. So I think there are some silver linings here.
You know, and just to add on that, not to extend it too long, but what I think is a real challenge for progressives in local races, even state races, is that, you know, on a national stage, there's a much easier case, a more simple, easily understood case to be made about, you know, the need for more women and ethnic diversity and representation in different offices. But when you get to local races, especially in Northern California, if you look at, or especially at the very least San Francisco and the Bay Area, I mean, we have so many women leaders, LGBT leaders. State Senator Scott Wiener, who in San Francisco is not billed as a progressive, is billed as a moderate, would say, you know, if you asked him, you know, I, in state Senate, I am very progressive by that standard of the state Senate, which is far more conservative and has Republicans in it. He is gay, you know, he represents the LGBT movement. He wore a wig and drag and heels to bike to raise awareness around a recent proposition. But at the same time, he also did not endorse Prop C. In fact, was against Prop C to fund homelessness. You know, he was against tent encampments in San Francisco. Politics of local politics and state politics are often about land use. They're about land use and about class and about poverty. And, you know, and especially in the Bay Area, when there's so much diversity and strong representation, it's hard for voters to understand the progressive moderate divides because they're so used to the national conversation. And so it's very easy for a moderate to say, oh, actually, I'm a progressive.
Right. That's Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez. He covers transportation for the San Francisco Examiner and writes the weekly Political On Guard column. We're also joined today by David Dayan, contributor to The Intercept and author of the book Chain of Title. It's about three Americans who uncover Wall Street's foreclosure fraud. Today we're talking about election results in California. And if there was something that you were watching closely and we haven't discussed yet, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's go next to Janice in Berkeley. Hi, Janice. Welcome to the show.
Hi. As respect to something, which was about going down ballot races, and I wanted you to know there's a great group that was actually founded in the Bay Area called Sister District at post-Trump election, and it's a group that, because Berkeley and the Bay Area is so blue, you know, how many times can we, it's not like we're going to campaign for Barbara Lee, the idea is to find sister districts in other states where we can make strategic inroads to help really in the national level. And we look at state houses and legislatures, and 30 of us just campaigned in Michigan for a state representative and a state senator. And Michigan wasn't a state we could flip, but it was a state where it was important to make inroads because they're so badly gerrymandered. Mm. And we won, actually. So they sent people to Pennsylvania, to Michigan, to Arizona, and I can't remember the fourth state, but it's a very carefully done, smart, ethical, tech-savvy group of actually women in the Bay Area, and they're doing exactly what the other caller was asking, which was strategically looking at how do you build your base and running Democrats in what are called good nested races. So I'd recommend Sister District for people to look at for strategic building in the long term.
Well, thank you for that. And to that point, I know a number of people from the Bay Area went to the Central Valley. Mm-hmm. Republican Representative Jeff Denham is holding a lead over Democrat Josh Harder. A number of people were on social media talking about that race. And right now, this one has been called. Jeff Denham, the Republican, won by just about 2,000 votes over Josh Harder, the Democrat. Have either of you been following this one?
I would not say that race is over.
It's not over?
We
have the mail-in ballots.
We talked about all these mail-in ballots, right, and provisional ballots. I would say when all's said and done in California, and none of the close races have actually been officially called, but I would think that Democrats will net three seats in the House from California, The three being down in Southern California, the seat held by Dana Rohrabacher, the seat currently held by Daryl Issa, who retired, but Mike Levin is the Democrat. He's going to take that seat. And the seat currently held by Steve Knight, author of the famous scion of the author of the Knight Amendment, which I'm sure everyone in San Francisco remembers. But Harder has a shot. I think that is narrow enough such that the late absentees, which traditionally trend Democratic, can make up that difference.
Can you talk about Rohrabacher? I mean, this is a Republican who has been in office for 30 years. This is a big deal that he lost to Democrat Harley Ruda. I don't know anything about him. Do you know anything about Harley Ruda, what kind of Democrat he is?
So Harley Ruda is like an entrepreneur, a businessman. He did run on Medicare for All.
Really?
And you know, it's kind of interesting. Hmm. He was endorsed by the New Democratic Coalition, which is sort of the centrist, business-friendly Democratic Coalition. But he also supported Medicare for All from the beginning of the race. So
wow.
It shows you how the center has shifted. There's going to be a lot of talk about whether Democrats, whether the election proved that centrists are the way to go, or the way to go is to go progressive and build your base. The truth is like putting jello on a wall because the center is moving. The center is shifting. And Harley Reid is a good example of that. But yes, this is a big deal. Obviously, sort of popularly now, Rohrabacher is thought about in terms of his relationship to Russia. But he has been really as brash and as obnoxious a Republican as we've had in California politics over the last 20, 30 years, and it looks like his district just changed enough over time that he couldn't keep up with it.
Yeah, this is a big deal. I mean, this is a guy who's been in Congress for 30 years, and as you said, some of the things that come out of this guy's mouth, he's a huge Trump supporter, and I just want to do the math to show how, you know, every vote really does count. Right now, without all the mail-in ballots, Harley Ruda, the Democrat, has won by about 2,680-something votes.
Yeah, and he won his primary by under 200 votes.
Wow.
He got into the top two by a margin of something like 200 votes.
And, I mean, can you elaborate on this, David? I think it's so important. So you have Harley Ruda, this Democrat, who was campaigning on a Medicare for All platform. And as you say, the center has moved. And I was just thinking about how the cable show pundits talk about the center. They always say the Democrats, the next president needs to be more to the center. I mean, it's so simplistic. But talk more about what you mean by that based on what we saw last night.
Right. Well, I mean, this was sort of a smorgasbord election that literally any interest group, whether you're talking about, you know, on the left side of the spectrum, whether it's the centrist coalition or the more liberal groups, can all pick something out and say that this proves my point, this proves my belief system. For example, centrists can say that the candidates who campaign more visibly on the left, people like Kara Eastman in Nebraska or Katie Porter in California, looks like she came up short in a similar district to Ruda's. They all lost. And members who were endorsed by the New Democrat Coalition PAC were most of the ones who won, who flipped seats. At the same time, about 20 of the candidates who flipped seats in the House support either expanding Social Security or Medicare, either through Medicare for All or through some sort of buy-in or public option or something like that. And that's a really different place than Democrats were in just 8 years ago. So, you know, you have to take these things sort of in context. What is the center? And what is advantageous to Democrats going forward? Is it to, you know, say we're not of the center, or to move the center and say these are popular ideas that should be at the center of the debate because they can be, they're attractive to all sides of the equation. And so we get caught up in these, you know, these labels and these ideas when it's really about moving where the electorate is.
Right.
That should be the key.
Exactly, because surprise, surprise, people do not want health insurance companies to say that they cannot have insurance based on a pre-existing condition, right? You give that to someone and they obviously, they're not going to want to let it go. I mean, if they had the public option, they'd fight for that. And once we get universal health care, you better believe that everybody's going to fight for that. And one day the Republicans are going to have to step back and change their position and say that they've supported it all along. We just got some breaking news that Attorney General Jeff Sessions has announced his resignation. Thank you, Ruby, for sending that email. And then I just got an alert from the LA Times. A lot of people saw this coming, right, David?
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't surprise me. I've you know, been on the phone here, so I hadn't seen that. But yeah, it's certainly not surprising. And now there's a stronger Senate majority to confirm really anyone that Trump wants. And you know what that means to the Mueller investigation is unclear. Trump sort of said, sort of hinted at his very combative press conference today that he wouldn't fire everyone involved with the Mueller investigation because that would be politically fraught. But you know that's what he says today. I mean, you know, ask him again in 5 minutes. So
right.
You know we'll see how that goes. But certainly not surprising. The guy has been humiliated for the better part of a year by his boss.
And we have just a couple minutes left. Joe, can you just give us a quick overview of the Board of Supervisors races in San Francisco?
Sure. There were some key races across the different neighborhoods in San Francisco representing kind of the west side, which is traditionally a very conservative area called District 4, kind of Sunset and Parkside. Lots of homeowners, lots of long-term San Franciscans, but like people who traditionally wanted more moderate center Democrats. But a Democrat who is closely identified with the progressive movement, Gordon Maher, seems to be in the lead right now, at least as far as the count and the tally show. That one's a bit of a nail biter, but a lot of folks analyzing it saying he will prevail his opponent Jessica Ho, which was interesting to see because Jessica Ho netted the endorsement of London Breed, Mayor London Breed, and a lot of other prominent Democrats. She has lived in the city and in that district since March. She announced her candidacy April, May, June, in June. So it was 3 months. She had lived there for 3 months. So there was a, you know, it's very interesting to see because the more conservative West Side may not be choosing Gordon Maher necessarily because they so much have changed into a progressive hotbed, but simply because they were not fond of someone new coming into their neighborhood and declaring that they would lead it. District 6, which is south of Market and the Tenderloin and some other neighborhoods near the downtown central core of San Francisco, is represented by Supervisor Jane Kim, who ran for mayor. Running for her seat was Matt Haney, a school board member who had the prominent backing of Van Jones and in a previous run of President Obama. But he was up against Christine Johnson and Sonia Trauss, who were heavily YIMBY-backed candidates. And, you know, that's kind of in the tail of the Bay Area and California lately is the rise of the YIMBY movement. But, you know, a lot of folks are saying that this may be a referendum on the YIMBY movement, at least in San Francisco, because in a neighborhood where most of our newcomers live around downtown and South of Market, when you the new tech workers, and as well as the Mission, of course, but also South of Market, to see them soundly reject the YIMBY candidates, Sonia Trauss, who, you know, helped found the Bay Area Renters Federation, was instrumental in the founding of YIMBY Action in San Francisco, to see her lose so resoundingly to Matt Haney seems to be a defeat of YIMBY policies, even in our most dense and a high-rise filled district. And that all these Haney has declared victory. Maher is still kind of in the running, but all of these recent wins show a progressive lock on San Francisco City Council, what we call the Board of Supervisors, which will be fascinating to see, because now they will most likely have a supermajority within their reach to pass city laws, which will allow them to pass laws that Mayor London Breed may have otherwise vetoed, which is going to be fascinating. You're going to see the progressive Board of Supervisors have to show what ideas they have to transform San Francisco as it grapples with homelessness and a sky-high rental crisis. Now is their time to put in laws that they think Mayor London Breed would not approve of, but they can get passed.
Well, that will be fascinating to watch. Just quickly, Robert, we can't take your call because we're almost out of time, but Joe, Robert wanted to know, why will Prop C be delayed a year for lawsuits, or in lawsuits, and will there be any rental subsidies?
Well, you know, it is interesting. So there's this idea that, you know, this idea by some tax hawks that you can't pass certain taxes without a kind of a two-thirds majority that's trying to be pushed. That's essentially the heart of this challenge. But London Breed has said and has come out and said in a statement earlier today that she would, because the voters of San Francisco showed a preference for Prop C despite her, you know, opposition to it, she would try to enact some proposals in the meantime. Now, whether that means fully funding homeless services and creating all the things Prop C said it would with city funds until Prop C is freed up legally, we won't know. You know, we don't know if this is piecemeal or if this is a grand vision yet, but it seems that tentatively she has announced that we will see some benefits now, but we don't know how big that will be just yet.
All right, and we will definitely do a show on that. David Dayan, about 30 seconds, a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Overall, what are your thoughts on these results, and what do they say about where California is going?
Well, like I say, the one from column A, one from column B election, everybody can look at it and see their own belief system kind of revealed, but as far as California is concerned, it's become sort of the presidency of liberal America, with Congress hopelessly gridlocked. There's not many other places in the country that can actually get policy done to move things forward in the public interest. And we'll see if Gavin Newsom is as committed to that as he campaigned on.
Yeah. We will see. David Dayan is contributor to The Intercept and author of the book Chain of Title. Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez covers transportation for the San Francisco Examiner and writes the weekly political column On Guard. David and Joe, thanks for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. Sorry about my coughing. Be sure to stay healthy. Take lots of vitamin C and stay warm. This is Your Call. I want to thank Malihei Razazan for producing today's show and Damian Miner, who is our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar.